And good morning, everyone, once again, all over the world, all over the time zones. 103 countries as of this morning. We are in at one time or another. I was watching the little dots glowing and blinking and talking to each other. I mean, those are cities. Those are consciousnesses. I think I did too many S's. Last night, we did a very interesting experiment at the end of the show with Marty Rosenblatt, who was our guest this morning again, briefly. Good morning, Marty. Marty, are you there?
Yeah, good morning, Richard.
Unmuting. You know, the Skype has got to do something different for muting and unmuting. It's Anyway, so let's do a brief reprise. You went through a couple of hours describing remote viewing and your experiences and some of the highlights. And then at the end of the show, we gave people a target, a target space. And while I focused on the target, you led a meditation into connecting with the target on the part of the audience. And we both have been looking at our responses since then. In fact, let's click on the second image, which is yours. We'll bring that up. And this is what you got, which was the number of the experiment. We gave it a number, right?
Right.
And then at the very bottom, it looks like you drew my hand.
Yeah, I agree. I would not consider this to be a very good match. And as we discussed yesterday, it's just not on all the time. We have to accept uncertainty. And plus, this wasn't really what I would call a full RV session. But I don't want to make any excuses. It would not be a good match.
Well, that's what I want to get back into, because if we go back to Radio with Pictures and we click on, we don't have to click on the target. Everybody can see it's what's called a Rubik's tetrahedron. When Marty said to me, you know, pick something, I looked around my office here, the studio, and I picked the first thing that's within reach of me, which was a little Rubik's tetrahedron. Tetrahedron, the physics, 19.5. Come on, guys. And the Rubik's part, if you rotate those little parts of the tetrahedron, you get the various color faces, like a Rubik's cube. But a Rubik's cube is a cube, and this is a tetrahedron, so it's a Rubik's tetrahedron. Anyway, I thought it was kind of, on the spur of the moment, multiple levels of the symbology. Because really, Marty, when we talk about connecting with objects or images of objects, we're basically purely looking at symbolism, right?
Right. In this case, triangles, if people had drawn a triangle, it certainly would capture part of it. And, of course, a tetrahedron itself in 3D.
Okay, we don't have a lot of time here, so let me go through two more. If you look under the image of the tetrahedron, the image of the key, click on the image of the key, everybody. That was sent by one of our listeners, Tim Saunders, who's over there in Turkey. And to me, this was incredibly interesting, because I would say this is a hit, but not directly, because look what it is. It's a key with what's called a trefoil. Three circles embossed in the handle of the key. And those, of course, is an equilateral triangle, which in 2D is a representation of a 3D tetrahedron. And it's a key. The key and the trefoil / tetrahedron symbology, well, the tetrahedron is the key to the physics that we've been discussing for decades, and the physics is the key to living and experience and existence and reality and the universe. And Marty, I would say that's a second level hit. What do you think?
Well, I like the three. We use a 0 to 7 scale. I would not necessarily wager on that, but I understand what you said. I'd probably give it a 3. Okay. On the 0 to 7 scale,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, moving quickly, and actually I think we're going to move our next... Can we move commercials? I don't know whether we can do that. I guess maybe we can't do that. So I'll tell you what we're going to do. When we come back, we're going to finish this, which is with two more images, and they have an important point connected to them. And then I will goodnight Marty and thank him for his services and for introducing us to how complex this is. And then we'll introduce my guest. So we are on the other side of midnight. My second guest waiting in the wings. My first guest waiting to do two more analyses. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
Mm-hmm.
And we are back on the other side of midnight. I'm holding over Marty for a couple of minutes here so we can go through the other analyses. The thing that's so interesting to me, if we go back to Radio with Pictures, look at the tetrahedron, look at the right-hand column of images. Yours is the next one down. The bottom one in the right-hand column is from one of our listeners named Ben. Click on that one, and then click on it again. Again, this is, to me, this is a hit, and I'll explain why in a second, but it's so symbolic. It's not exactly what I was holding, but it's related both symbolically, geometrically, and mathematically to what I was holding. Marty?
Yeah, I can see that.
So for those who can't, let me describe what it is. It is a cube. He says a cube. Okay, a cube is a double tetrahedron nested one inside the other, each tip on the corners of the cube. So that's really a double tet. The Saturn with a ring, that's, I don't know where to put that, but the Masonic symbol on the ring, that's obviously directly derivative from the equilateral triangle of the tetrahedron and the central premise of Masonic mythology, which is hyperdimensional torsion field tetrahedral physics. So Ben got it, but he didn't draw what I was holding. He drew the higher level connections to what I was drawing.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
What do you think?
I think that it demonstrates how difficult judging is. You know, we talked a little bit about associative remote viewing, where you have to make one comparison to one picture to the other. If the other had been a whale jumping out of the water, you would definitely connect this one with your tetrahedron.
But these are very nonlinear. To me, this illustrates the process is nonlinear, incredibly symbolic, and maybe some night during a full moon it doesn't work, and the next Thursday it will, that kind of thing. It's temporally variable. And let's go to Darren, which is the last image in the left-hand column. I find this really interesting, Darren. He writes, I saw a smooth, highly polished object, maybe a shell, a conch. But if you click on it, look at the top of the figure that he drew. Marty, what's that?
A half moon?
No.
A quarter moon?
No, the tip of that figure. Forget the whole figure. Just look at the tip of it. Yes, it's a tetrahedron. It's a 3D tetrahedron in perspective. So people are getting fragments. Part of it was probably due to the fact that we didn't give them enough time. So maybe next time we allocate, what, a half hour? To really, you know, I wasn't briefed as to how long we needed to do this.
Right.
I assumed 15 minutes would be okay, but hey, it's a work in progress. I think this is a qualified success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. Judging is one of the most difficult aspects of this, and that was the analysis part. And the CIA had problems with that as well, because they weren't exact matches. And when you're looking for new information, the judging and the analysis is absolutely critical. And that's what you've just done here. So that's great.
Well, we definitely illustrated the process and the complexity. And Marty, I want to thank you so much. And we will obviously have you back. We'll give you more warning and we'll set up an experiment better. But I hope people see that there's the gestalt here of information, but it's not what you'd expect on what? Sesame Street. Mm-hmm. It's higher level and more. Has more depth.
Let me just say one other thing. The trained ones, the ones that have done this for really a long time, it's remarkable how much more they can get than here. Here we had to kind of use metaphors and things like that. Sometimes they're just like right on. And I think next time I will put some of those examples.
Oh, that'd be stunning.
In your pictures, yeah.
Marty, thank you so much. And this concludes a very important segue, which is connecting last night with tonight, and people can see there's something here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
Okay, my primary guest of the evening, I'm going to take us to the closing hours and the closing music of the closing weekend, is my old friend Grant Cameron. Let me scroll over here and pick up something. I want to give – we had Grant on briefly – kind of like, you know, a week ago, week and a half ago, maybe 2 weeks, and then suddenly he got taken away from us. So tonight we're going to see if that history and maybe repeats itself. However, I don't think it's going to. So let me kind of get into this here. Grant Cameron became involved in ufology as the Vietnam War ended in May of 1975 with a personal sighting of an object which locally became known as Charlie Red Star. The sighting occurred in Carmen, Manitoba Island, about 25 miles north of the Canada-U.S. border. Hundreds of other people sighted the object at the same time during a prolonged flap of sightings. During the next 18 months, he had many other sightings of large objects and small monitor objects in the area. He spent countless days photographing a series of strange objects and interviewing hundreds of witnesses who were involved. These interviews became part of a manuscript called Tales of Charlie Red Star, which is in the process of being published. Stories from the book will also be part of a movie being made, planned in Toronto, with a contactee group called Rama. So, Grant, let's try again. Good morning and welcome to The Other Side of Midnight.
Good morning, Richard. How are you doing? And thanks for your interest. And I think it'll work out. I agree with you. I think it'll work out this week.
I think we passed a political Rubicon, and so let's leap right into it. What happened 3 days ago that you think has changed the political landscape, not only for this subject, but for an awful lot of things that go bump in the night?
3 days ago?
About 3 days ago.
Oh. I don't really know.
I thought you were going to write a book on this. I thought you might be following. Hillary Clinton is now the presumptive nominee on the Democratic side. So, officially, a presidential nominee of a major party who stands a 1 in 50 chance, 50-50, of being the next president, has formally said now many, many times in various media, she wants to get to the bottom of the UFO issue. Grant, do you believe her?
I believe her because I point out that it's really not her. She has never brought up the subject. People think that she's doing it for votes or she's doing it for whatever. The whole thing is John Podesta. Hillary, I think, brought up to Hillary. She never would have brought up the issue, and she doesn't bring up the issue. She has answered four questions. And to put the thing into perspective, what actually happened was that her campaign chairman, John Podesta, is very much into science fiction. He was known as the X-Files man in the Clinton White House. And he started, this would be, I believe it was October of last year, to encourage reporters to ask Hillary about the aliens. And it all began in December when she took her first question.
December 2015.
At the end of the month, Damon Steer, who worked for the Conway Daily Sun in New Hampshire, which is a key state because it's one of the states where you basically have to win the state to get some momentum. Iowa happens first, New Hampshire happens second, but New Hampshire is the big one where if you win that, then you've got the momentum and you go off. So most campaigns spend, 6 months there or more.
Well, you can do what's called retail politics. You can go to door to door. You do town meetings. You go to restaurants. You go to barbershops. Yeah. New Hampshire, I remember I lived in Massachusetts, and we used to do a lot of singing in New Hampshire. New Hampshire is a small state. It's a very friendly state. It's an incredibly beautiful state. And you can reach a lot of people, retail politics, if you just spend the money and the time. But you also do not want to do things that will damage your credibility. So the fact that she answered forthrightly a question at that Conway, New Hampshire editorial board meeting on this subject at the beginning of the primary season, I found it stunning. And then I said, wait a minute, there's got to be something more going on here. And that's what you think.
Yeah, and that's where Podesta, when I saw that there was she did an interview with Lena Dunham, and that's where John tweets and says, good interview, Leah. Next time ask her about the aliens. And at that point, I knew something was up because the way campaigns work, as far as I know, is that everything is put in front of a focus group. Everything is polled. You basically put your finger in the wind and you see which way the swing voters are going. and that's how you set up your campaign. So the fact that John Podesta would say to Leah Dunham, ask her about the aliens, means that he pulled the issue. He had to have pulled the issue because a presidential campaign is a $1 billion operation, and there's no way that you would present an issue into the campaign unless you knew for sure that it wasn't going to kill the campaign. And if you go back to 2008, when Dennis Kucinich took the question, during this October 2007, maybe it was 2006, let's see. No, it was the debate that took place in Philadelphia. And anyway, what happened with him was Shirley MacLaine had in her book the story that Dennis Kucinich had seen a UFO on her balcony of her her estate and had heard voices. And so the Wall Street Journal actually picked up the story, and he confirmed to the Wall Street Journal, yes, he had seen this object, but he didn't hear any voices. And his Shirley MacLaine's bodyguard was there, the bodyguard's girlfriend was there, and that they had known all day something was going on. So this event happens. They all draw what they saw, which never became public.
No.
Wall Street Journal was supposed to release this, but what happened was as soon as the debate took place, he was asked the question, did you see a UFO and did you hear voices? And he immediately said, well, yes, I saw a UFO, but no, I didn't hear voices. And Jimmy Carter saw a UFO, and his campaign was over. I checked every article that was written about him after that statement.
You mean just finish?
Kucinich.
Yeah, that turned his campaign to toast.
Yeah, exactly.
Just to mention that he'd seen something years before, decades before.
25 years before,
Yeah. And that's what's so different politically about this, because not only is the subject not persona non grata, and we're going to get back to this in a second, but I'm going to leave you with this thought. Isn't it interesting that in all his attacks on Hillary, the one thing Donald Trump is not using as a weapon is the UFO weapon.
Yeah.
And why not? So before we answer that, everybody think about that one. Just kind of mull that over in your mind. Let's go back to Grant Cameron, the person. Before we can believe what people say on the show, I kind of have to establish who they are and what they've been doing and all that. And you have a very extraordinary career both in and out of this field. So why don't we go back to that Charlie Red Star thing and tell us, which was abbreviated the last time, how did you get into this arcane field, which is about to become, Grant, mainstream?
Yeah, well, what happened was I had no interest in UFOs that I can recall. I was interested in near-death experiences. I was interested into psychics, like I studied Edgar Casey and stuff, but no interest in UFOs. And what happened was, as the Vietnam War was ending, it started in February of 2005, a small town, but 35 miles southwest of the big city I live in here, Carmen, Manitoba, started getting almost nightly objects being seen. And in March of that year, we used to drive around the city, do nothing. I said to my friend, who I still have coffee with every week, and this is like 40 years later, wow. I said to him, well, why don't we go to Carmen and see what everybody's looking at? And he said, yeah, okay, we'll do that. And we never did. And then what happened was...
You planned to go and find out what everybody was talking about, yeah, and you wound up not doing it.
Never went. And if there was a second event that occurred, a big event, the local media was covering it. And then in the early days of May 1975, there was a local TV station. It was part of the CTV affiliate here. And they went out and they caught this thing on the ground. And as it was jumping into the sky... The guy filmed this thing jumping off the ground into the sky, and it was a film that Jay Allen Hynek got two copies of. It went viral all around North America. NBC picked it up. It was a big story.
Well,
and it was
back in those days, there was only the networks. There wasn't any internet, so going viral just meant the news agencies talked about it.
The big news agencies, and this is coming out of Canada. And so,
I remember seeing that. It looked like something sitting on the ground with twinkling lights or something.
Yeah, and the guy that shot it wasn't even a cameraman. What had happened was they had tried to get this thing on the ground because a number of the networks were out there trying to film this thing. And so they were paying overtime to the reporters and stuff. So what happened was the associate news director at the local station said, "That's the end of this nonsense. I'm not paying any more overtime. This is a waste of time. This is garbage." And he said, "Anybody wants to go can go on their own time." And so this crew went out. It was reporters and a guy who'd never shot a TV camera before in his life. He was a film editor in the film room. Actually went out with a camera, and as this thing was so they could see it on the ground, he was about 8 miles away, and he said, "Well, next time this thing glows up, I'm going to shoot." And so the thing glowed up. He shot, and the thing jumped up in the air, almost like it was almost staged. And then it flew through the sky, and of course, suddenly this thing becomes viral. The TV station is in a position where they didn't pay the crew. They told them to go on their own time. It became sort of a scandal, which is really has never been really made public. But anyway, they get this thing, and then I said to my friend, when we saw this film that they were showing on the TV, and it was a big story, I said, "Come on, let's go see what they're looking at." And as I always describe it, it's the old story that you buy a lottery ticket and you think, "There's a chance I can win, but I'm not going to win."
Yeah.
And so I go out there and expecting to see nothing. We went in the town, out of the town, in the town, and we were looking at various things. I really didn't know anything about astronomy or anything. And we're watching, you know, Venus setting, and we're watching, you know.
How old are you? 18, 19?
21, 22.
Okay.
And so we're watching all this different stuff, and I have no idea whatsoever what everybody's looking at. And we say, "Well, you know, is that what they're looking at?" And we're looking at, like, probably I think it was Venus setting or something. Mm. And we're going, like, "Is that what they're looking at?" And this is
which
like
twinkles vigorously, by the way, near the horizon, and it turns all kinds of cool colors.
Yeah, and it's fairly big. And this is like this is a small town of 2,000 people with nothing around it, so it's pretty dark. You know, it's set out in the middle of nowhere, and so. We were watching all this stuff, and then my friend said, "Well, we'll drive out of town. We'll drive into town one more time, and if we don't see anything, we'll go home." I said, "Fine with me. This is a total waste of time." So we drive out of the town, and as we're coming back into town, we're about a mile out of the town, and the thing appeared from the left to the right. It was down low, very close to the road, and I still recall it's the old thing, like when you see it, it's hard to describe to people when you see something really up close. It's like this absolute certainty. It was like nobody in the car. There's three people in the car. Nobody said, "I wonder if that's what they're looking at." It's like everybody instantly said, "There it is." And it was like pandemonium. And I remember what happened. It was down so low. It came right in front of the car. And there was a set of school buses. They were parking school buses at this sort of a lot there. And this thing, it appeared it was going to go in behind these school buses. So I was actually getting out of the car. The car was still moving. I was getting out of the car because I wanted to run through the parking lot to get to these school buses and just watch this thing sort of, it was pulsing. It was red. It looked like a heartbeat, like it was alive. And it was just sort of pulsing. It was like a plasma type object.
So you couldn't see a definite shape. It was glowing.
No. Yeah.
Pulsing, and glowing, changing colors?
No, it was just pulsing red. It looked like a red heart.
About how
big? Well, you couldn't tell because it was at night. It was pitch dark. It looked like you could tell it was longer than it was high.
Right.
It was very intense, very low, moving very, very slow. I mean,
And how bright was the pulsing red light?
Oh, very, very bright. I mean, it was a very distinct. That's what I said. It was like something like you absolutely knew this is what everybody's talking about. It was like instantaneous. And it just the strange thing was it was more the second night. It went out two nights later. The second night, it was more apparent to me. But both times, it was this thing where
– So wait a minute. You saw it more than once.
Oh, I saw it numerous times.
Well,
it's
important to establish.
Yeah, I saw it the first night. And then what happened was I said to – I grabbed every friend I had, and I said, "You got to come see this. This is like – you know, I was like I'd seen Jesus or something, you know." And I dragged all my friends out there, and it was an area where a lot of people were out there trying to see this thing, the people coming from the big city. And it was probably a Friday night, I think the second night or Saturday night, so people were able to come out late. And we were trying to find the airport at this our landing strip in this town. And because it was just a little tiny landing strip, they didn't have the lights on at night. There was no runway lights.
Right.
So we didn't know. We were standing right beside the runway, and we didn't really realize. And we were trying to find it because we knew that the main guy that was sort of setting up the tour groups and showing people where to go and what to see and stuff was the guy that ran that airport. And so we were sitting there, and there was like 25 people on this road. There was kids in every road. There was people all sitting around waiting for this thing to appear. So there was 25 people.
Like that scene out of Close Encounters.
Exactly.
Anybody have a camera?
There was a second night. There was somebody there with a camera. We were sitting there, and the car beside us had a it was a courier car, and the one guy did have a camera. And it was when motor drives first came out for cameras. You remember these motor drives?
I remember Nikon.
Yeah, and so he had his camera there, and of course I had. There's 25 people there when it first started. When the thing finally arrived, there was only 8 of us left because my friend said, this is garbage. We're going home. I said, no, you got to see this, man. You got to see this. Don't go. And they said, no, I can still remember the last parting words. They said, Graham, we're hungry. We're going back to Winnipeg for pizza. And that was it. All my friends and, you know, they all just took off and in their cars and they all left. And there was 8 of us left when it finally came. And I remember the second night, it was completely different. I had some kids that were about 13, 14. They were doing science fair project type things in school. They were with us. And they were sitting out in the field. We're standing on this gravel road, and they were sitting in the field. And there was a flash, like it looked like a flash cube from a you know, the old cameras, just a flash on the horizon. Uh-huh. And one of the kids yells, "Is that it?" And I said, well, "I don't know, maybe." I had no idea because it didn't look like the first night.
Tell you what, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. We have a short break. Grant Cameron, my guest this morning, talking about a very famous UFO sighting in Canada, which started him on a trek to figure out what do the presidents of the United States know about UFOs? And the answer will be surprising. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight. We have Grant and 7 of his friends, the hardliners, out in the field in the middle of the night, and there's something on the horizon.
Yeah. So you want me to keep going?
Please.
Okay. So anyway, this flash occurs on the western horizon. We're looking into the west, and there's actually 4 people plus. There's 1, 2, 3, 4 in our car and the 4 in this other car. So there's 8 people there. And then it flashes once, and then it flashes a second time, but it moves like 8 inches in the field of vision. It was like poof,
wow.
Suddenly it's in another part of the sky, and then it boom, and again, and it's bouncing around like. And later it would be described by 2 young kids who I interviewed in the area, and they would describe this watching this out of their bedroom window every night. They called it the bouncing ping pong ball.
I was just going to say it sounds like Pong.
Yeah, it's like
the first video game.
Yeah, and that's exactly – when these kids described that, I went, oh, I've seen that. I know exactly what they're talking about. And so this thing was bouncing around.
So it was – wait. It was sending a message. If it's intelligent, it knew Pong was on everybody's mind, every kid. It was sending a geometric message in the language of Pong.
Well, possibly, or there's another scenario that I'll explain in a second when you talk about this film that was shot by the CKY guys.
Okay.
So but every time it would flash as it was coming, it looked like it was coming at us. And as it came closer, the flashes got closer together, but they're still bouncing around. And then it came in closer. And I remember it was like being at a football game where the local team is scoring a touchdown. It was like people screaming and swearing, and it was like,
there's only eight of you.
There's only 8, and in the other car, there's 3 men, and there's a woman, and she can't see it because it's bouncing around the sky, and she's crying, and people are yelling and screaming, and this girl saying, I can't see it. Where is it? And I can just remember this girl crying, people yelling and screaming, and this camera click, zzz, click. Zzz, click. And this guy was literally unloading the camera as this thing was coming at us. And so we were watching, and as it got closer, then suddenly it changed from this flashing cube or flash thing to what I'd seen the first night, this red plasma type object. And it was coming directly at us, and it was getting closer and closer. It was down low again, and then it sort of made a turn, We're looking in the west. It made a turn and they headed off sort of towards the northeast. And this was the reports that later on people would report that it would come sort of up to the town and then it would sort of turn. It would go around sort of the north side of town. Hmm. So it was making this turn going to the right towards the north side of town. And I remember these people in the other car said, "We're going to chase it." And they get into the car and they all jump in the car and the gravel is just flying. They just go speeding off. And this did happen a number of times that you could actually catch up on this thing, that you could actually gain on this thing if you were chasing it. And I did one time where I actually drove off the end of a road and at that point learned about how the world was round because we had these mile roads where they would put these mile roads, would run every mile north and south. But every 8 miles or whatever, they moved the road over 50 feet. And so one night we were actually chasing this thing. I actually drove right off the end of a road because we were actually catching up on it. I wasn't even watching the road, and we were driving along. And so these people took off after this thing. And I remember watching this thing head off into the north.
So it was playing catbird with you.
Oh, numerous times. It would actually.
And for those who don't know what I'm saying, if you ever studied ornithology, and when I was a kid, I was into birds. Yeah. When you approach a catbird, if a catbird builds a nest, and there are other birds that do this too, brown thrashers sometimes and some others, if you build it too low and your cat or your dog gets too close or you get too close, the mother catbird will fall out of the nest and pretend she has a broken wing and will flutter just out of reach of you or the dog or the cat until you're far enough away, and then she'll go, eh, and fly away.
Yeah.
That's what this was doing with you.
Yeah, numerous times. And so we used to love this. We used to chase this thing all the time. And then we had an incident that occurred the year later where suddenly it turned and it came at us. I mean, it was sort of like it was chasing us. And it was like the scariest moment of my life. I got very, very close. I had this object sitting right on top of the car. It was either very, very close or very, very big. Because when I looked up at this object, it was a triangle object. It had two red lights and then a green light in the back, in the back side of the triangle. And the blunt side of the triangle was coming towards us. So it wasn't the sharp edge. It was the blunt side. And so right above us, I see these two lights. And in the binoculars, it was the entire field of vision, everything. That's all I could see was these huge, huge lights. Or that's what appeared to me. It was like either three objects that were completely staying in proportion to each other, or it was three lights on an object which you really couldn't see anything between. One of the kids in the car, I interviewed him like 30 years later, and I'd never talked to him. And he said, well, it had the metal. I said, I didn't see any metal. What do you mean metal? I was so petrified when this thing turned on us. But the first night, the second night when this thing was flying off, it had a green glow on the backside of this this pulsing red object. And I remember watching it, same as the first night, just slowly pulsing, flying off into the distance. And I was thinking to myself, geez, that could actually be from another planet or from another solar system. And I'm going, what the heck's it doing? Because it just looked like it was flying along burning gas. It didn't look like it was doing anything. It was just didn't seem to be doing anything. It was just, and I was just so, it just mystified me. I go, what's it doing? And we had numerous times where we would chase it, and I had the one where it was on top of the car. This is when we got these what were called little tiny monitors. I called them ground lights, and then talked to a guy who had worked with the Canadian government program in the early 1950s, Wilbert Smith, who ran the Canadian government program.
Project Magnet.
And this was a radio engineer who worked with him, who was a metallurgist who worked for the Department of Defense here in Canada, worked on different types of recovering Russian nose cones and trying to figure out how high the Russians were launching missiles and stuff. So he had a classified job and said, you know, he wished he'd never gotten into it. He was interested. He was the youngest guy on the team, and it ruined his career. He never got promoted after he got involved.
Retrieving Russian hardware falling out of orbit ruined his career? Why?
No. Getting involved with the UFO thing. He got involved with Wilbur Smith.
So by getting involved with Wilbur Smith, it ruined his career.
Yeah, and because he was a metallurgist, Wilbur Smith, as you probably know, was getting a lot of pieces from the United States. He would get all these pieces, and he would have these things analyzed. And this was the guy he used for the analysis.
Ah.
Now, this was all off the record, and yet they knew he was doing this. And he said to me, it ruined my career. I wish I'd never gotten into it. It was very interesting and stuff. but it really didn't help me. And when I described these small objects on the ground that started to appear in 1976, I said to him, well, we're looking, because he lived in the area. And the only reason he talked to me was because Wilbur Smith's wife, Wilbur Smith had died then. Mm-hmm. This is 1977. I went to Ottawa to interview Wilbur Smith's wife, and she was amazed that this young kid had flown across Canada to come and talk to her. And so she said, I've got a guy in Manitoba. This is where I live, and this is in the sighting area. There was this guy lived there now. He was a manager of a credit union in this another small town about maybe 20 miles south of Carmen. And so I went there, and we saw them, that I was ready to jump on it when it ran a decoy move and sat one on top of a car. There was a bunch of these things around. But I was so close that I was going to jump on it. So there's no doubt.
So wait, these were like little drones, little robots,
We called them ground lights because they would sit on these, what I call these mile roads, like these mile roads that go to nowhere. Like this one was heading towards the United States.
Right.
So it was a north-south road. And what had happened is 1976, what I would do is I'd take people out there who wanted to film the big object. So people would say, oh, I can film it. And they'd bring out these, you know, 2,500 millimeter, you know, telephoto lenses. And everybody would have, you know, all these guys. And because I really wasn't into photography, but I worked at University of Manitoba. So I had some access to some people, and they would all volunteer to come out. And everybody was trying to do these filming. So I had one night I had a friend of mine there, and he had his camera. And we were sitting at a town 11 miles east of Carmen. And we're waiting for the big one to fly, some of these big ones to fly. And they would usually start just after dusk.
This sounds so much like right out of Close Encounters.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're standing on this side of this road.
If this was so regular and repeatable, how come media didn't come out and cover it?
Well, media was there. That's what film you're talking about is the carp film out of Ontario. That was a little bit different. This one, it was shown in the documentary UFO Cover-Up Live. If you look in there, you can see the Carmen film. It's shown by Bob Berry, who was a UFO researcher out of Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. who came to do a lecture, and he got a copy of the film. Now, this gets into really bizarre stuff, because the film, he had a copy, and I tried to recover it after he died, because when I went to the guy who had filmed it, there was these two little 6-inch pieces of film that he had gotten, they'd put together, which was shown, which became famous. When I went to get a copy of the film, he said, oh, I can't give you a copy of the film. Every time I give somebody a copy of the film, weird things start happening. He says, the film keeps disappearing. And I said, oh, okay, whatever. And so then he phones me up and he says, okay, I got a copy of the film. So he had he gave me a second generation copy of the film. And when I moved, I sold my house about 7 years ago. Do you think I could find that film? It was on a 6-inch metal reel. And I mean, like, you're not going to miss this. It's like, I don't have any film reels. And it was the only film reel I had. It was 6-inch film reel. And the film was gone. I missed it. And he said the same thing happened, that this film would disappear every time he would give people film. The film that he gave to people would disappear. But he got this film, and Bob Berry happened to get a copy of the film. And so when he died, I tried to recover his film. But his was gone as well. The wife and the people who had it, they couldn't tell me where the film was. And it's shown on there. And what happens was this thing jumps up in the sky, and it's called a flash frame. And if you look at the Billy Meyer thing, there's in one of the Billy Meyer films, there's what's called a flash frame as well, where the whole flame sort of lights up. And it's sitting on the ground, and the guy is to film this thing. And he says, next time it glows, I'm going to shoot. He's 8 miles away, because we know, because the thing was on the ground, and there was people near it when it was on the ground. And it was sitting like a movie screen. Like I said, like a drive-in movie screen, but it wasn't touching the ground. And it was blood red. It was sitting on this movie screen type thing, not touching the ground. So they saw it, and as they were there, they were looking around to get their perspective with different microwave towers to see where they were, because they're in the middle of nowhere. And the guy is 8 miles away, says, next time it goes up, I'm going to shoot. So it starts to glow up, and he shoots, and this thing jumps up in the air. The people that are around it on the ground are looking around, and they go, where'd it go? And they're looking around, and they thought it disappeared. And actually, it was, I think, 5,000 – somebody did analysis, 5,000 feet above their head. And on the film, you see this thing glow, and then you see there's three frames of film. It's on the bottom of the frame, The next frame, it's what's called a flash frame. It lights up the entire horizon. It's only one frame of film, so 1/24th of a second. The entire you can see the entire horizon of the film. And in the third frame, this thing is 5,000 feet in the air. It's at the top of the frame. So if you go to the UFO Cover Up Live documentary, it was done at the closing days of the Reagan administration, which may be significant because what we're seeing now is in the closing days of the Obama administration. Mm. You have this film, which everybody in 1988 thought was a release, because that in that documentary you have a number of significant things. You have, this is the introduction of the Condor and the Falcon. This is the introduction of the live alien, the whole idea about the live alien with the strawberry ice cream.
I was going to say, with the strawberry ice cream and the Tibetan bells.
Yeah, and this is this introduction.
Oh, my God. I watched that live, and I said to myself, this is phony as a $3 bill.
And that's what they wanted. It was done by Gray Advertising out of New York City.
And at the end, they gave everybody 800 number. Oh, if you've seen a UFO, call us, please. Yeah. And I'm thinking, this is back in the 70s. Oh, my God, they're casting a net. They want to get everybody in the same room.
Yeah, and they did get a lot of phone calls. A lot of people
I can imagine.
And
this is all pre-internet. This is good old phones and television.
Yeah, so this is late October of 1988. The election is a couple weeks later in November. And they introduced the live alien, the Condor, the Falcon, the whole thing about
the aviary, the whole idea of UFO experts with all these bird names.
Yeah, and two other significant things were Area 51. They have on it, there's a flow chart. If you look at the documentary, there's a flow chart they show there, which I say is very significant because you got to remember Bill Moore was behind this whole thing. And Bill Moore, when we asked him, like there was this DC-5, and we were saying, what's DC-5? And he would never really explain to us. It was on the flow chart. We took the flow chart very seriously. And it shows two significant things. One is Area 51. This is October 1988. Bob Lazar would not go on the site until December of 1988. His story would not be broken until March of 1988, when George Knapp at KLS-TV in Las Vegas didn't have somebody for one of his interviews, and he phones up John Lear and he said, you know that friend of yours that got fired at Area 51? Can you do an interview tonight? This happens in March of the next year. So Area 51 would not become public until that interview, when it goes viral around the world in March of 1989. So 88, in October, it's on this flowchart. You can see very clearly it says this is part of the whole thing, Area 51. So they're introducing these concepts. And the other concept that I've now gotten very much into is you will see they show the flowchart of how the UFO how it runs. And they've got the president at the top, and right under him they have MJ-12, which makes a lot of sense, because if I look back now, and one of the reasons I've changed my opinion as to whether the president knows, I now believe the president knows. And if you look back at
when
the
you
original,
say the president, all presidents or just
all presidents,
even the current president.
Even the current, well, okay. Especially the current president.
Especially. Okay. Let's stop you there. Hang on. Yeah. We have lost a thread. I want to know how Grant Cameron, young, almost teenager, bopping around town following a friendly dog-like UFO, which wants you to catch him, maybe and maybe not, how does that guy become a preeminent presidential historian on the subject of ufology?
Okay, here's what happens.
We're missing some glue here.
Okay. I spend a year and a half in this town. I basically quit university. I didn't quit. I kept taking a couple of
courses. So you fell into the whole UFO thing.
Oh, I fell off the edge of the earth. My friend who I have coffee with, I will have sometimes people will be with us, and I'll be telling the story, and then I'll say, yeah, Larry and I were there the first time, and they go, you were there? And they'll go to my friend, you were there? And he says, yeah, I was there. So what'd you see? Whatever Grant says, that's what we saw. He has no interest whatsoever. It's like, you know, he just went on with his life, and I just fell off the edge of the earth. So I spend a year and a half there, and I interview everybody I can find. I figure, man, this is the most significant story. Why is nobody covering this story? So I go to everybody.
Okay,
I go to the guy
who's running the apartment. Just for context, you're about 22, 23, yep. Right?
Yeah.
You're obsessed with ufology, and you're going to crack the code sitting in a town south of Manitoba.
Yep. Exactly.
At the same exact time, at 23 – I'm advising Cronkite.
Wow.
So that was my obsession. That's why I'm on the show tonight. So at that young age, we each defined a path, a journey.
Yeah.
Please continue.
I gather all the material. I put this manuscript that's now being published. I put it together. I send it to a bunch of publishers in Toronto. One of them has a board that reads it. Everybody comes back, says, you know, no, I don't think we'll do it. And I go to the local publisher here. And so they're no longer around. But I live in a city of about 700,000 people. So it's a fairly big place.
Oh, it's fairly big.
And everybody here knew what was going on. I mean, this is a big story. So I go to the local publisher who should have published this thing because it was a big story. And in the town, half the people in the town, in the poll I had done at the high school, 59% of the kids said they had seen something. And
so when you say local publisher, you mean newspaper publisher?
No, this is a book publisher.
Oh, okay.
And I go to her and I send her the manuscript, and the rejection letter I get says the following: Mr. Cameron, you may believe in this kind of stuff. Count me among the unbelievers. And I went, wow. And I just said, this is a total waste of time. This is an absolute waste of time. And I have never done sightings since. And I've had a lot of arguments with people. I say sightings is a total waste of time because I can tell you about wanting to jump on this little object that I was 50 feet away from. I can tell
Grant,
you all the stories.
Grant,
and
Grant.
All they are is just stories.
Grant, how yeah. amazingly perceptive of you. Because about the same time, after I met Benny and Barney Hill and spent an entire night debriefing them, I came to the same conclusion. The chasing sightings, chasing people who chase sightings, we're never going to get to anywhere because you let the phenomena control the research.
Yeah.
You have to invert the equation. So at the same time, roughly same age, you and I reach the same conclusion, which is why Enterprise does not do UFOs. Now, that does not mean I'm not interested, but I chose a path that I felt was more productive scientifically, and God knows, look what we got all over the solar system now. And you chose a path which led you directly, ultimately, someday, to a president who's about to make the announcement. Interesting the way history works. So please continue.
Yeah. So I do this. I get this rejection, which just blows me away. And then I say to myself, all I'm interested in is, what did I see? Because I was blown away by what I saw. And I said, there has to be somebody who knows what's going on here. And so that's when I start the chase. And it happens synchronistically, however you want to call it. My father's a pilot for the Canadian government for the Department of Transport, the same agency that ran Project Magnet. But my father wasn't involved. He was just a pilot. He inspected runways and up in the Arctic and stuff. And there's a guy in my father's office who happened to work for Wilbur Smith.
Uh-huh.
And he happened to have a sighting. So this guy's name is Ernie Epp, and my father says, well, Ernie had a sighting. He wants to talk to you. So I go and I talk to this Ernie Epp guy, and he says, you know, if you really want to know what's going on with UFOs, you should investigate Wilbur Smith. I used to work for him. And I said, oh, really? And he said, yeah, he ran the Canadian government UFO program.
Talk about serendipity.
Yeah, and he said, and the guy was totally crazy. I said, really? And he said, yeah. he was talking to the aliens, and they were landing in his backyard, and he was talking to the aliens. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, he was the smartest guy I ever met, but he was totally crazy when it came to UFOs. So I went, he was talking to aliens? He said, yeah. And I went, well, that's who I got to talk to. But he was dead. And that's why I flew across Canada as this young kid to talk to his wife, because I'd heard this story. And then I went and talked to her, and I said,
whose name was Merle?
Merle Smith. And she, at the time, synchronistically, happened to be just retiring from the Canadian government. And she was secretary to the Speaker of the Senate.
Oh, my God.
So she had a high-level job. And what happened is, if you know Canadian politics, the Canadian government is very divided. You have to be bilingual. So there's the French and the English thing. And Ottawa is right on the border of Quebec. So at that time, the French thing was coming into the Canadian government that you had to speak French. And she was upset about this. She didn't like this idea that the French were moving in. And you've always had this sort of debate. So she was very upset, and she was ready to talk. So I gather her together with her son, James.
So she was kind of like a disgruntled employee who was unhappy over policy. And to get back at them, I'm going to tell you some secrets.
Yeah, she was prepared to talk. And she went from her place. I picked her up. I got her rent a car. I picked her up and we went to her son's place. And his son is James Smith. He's the oldest son. And he's been interviewed a number of times because he was old enough at the time when his father was there to remember the pieces being brought by military cars and all the metal hardware. And he asked his father, as he was dying of cancer of the lower bowel, so he knew he was dying. And James asked him right at the end of his life, he said, did you see the bodies? And his father said, Yes, I was shown the bodies and I was shown the craft. There's nothing you can do to me anymore. And he claimed to have seen a craft outside of Washington, D.C., and the bodies. And the bodies were not Grays. I asked his son. His son's been interviewed a number of times. Were they Grays? He said, no. His father said they were like us, but they were very small. And so I
they were humanoid, but small.
Small. The same sort of description.
Like the hobbits, about their size?
Well, no, he didn't get into that. He just said that they were small. Human type. In fact, Wilbur Smith says publicly, and if you look at his material, he says they could pass on the street. I would know who they are, but they would pass on the street.
So they're family.
They have to be
family.
You got to remember, this is going back to the 1950s.
I know, this is
the Grays don't appear until 1962, and there's actually a pretty weird story that I can get into. There's a weird story.
Let's hold the weird story until after the top. I have two important questions here about Smith. Did Smith's son get any of his notes, his diaries, his papers, his whatever?
I have everything. 10,000 pages. I have it.
You have it.
Well, I have copies of everything. Yeah.
Fantastic.
So we have it all, and he actually wrote a book. He wrote a book called The New Science.
Was this Wilbur?
Wilbur Smith.
Wilbur wrote the book, okay.
It's called The New Science, and it was never – there was the last chapter was never finished, but it talks about how the universe works. And he says right at the beginning, it says in the introduction to the book, dictated to Wilbert Brockhaus Smith by beings more advanced than we are. And so he was a contactee. And this is back in those days, it was ugly to be a contactee. Now it's like if you say, you know, I've been talking to aliens, nobody really pays much attention.
Well, there were two divisions, weren't there, Grant? There were contactees from the 50s, and then there were the abductees like Betty and Barney.
But that didn't start till later, and that's where this weird story comes
from.
That
started in the 60s. All right, let's hold that story till after the station break. Let's see, there was something else I wanted to ask. If they were like us but somewhat smaller, and they're indistinguishable unless you somehow know something, that means they had to be family.
Yeah, that was the idea. You got to remember, back in the 1950s, that was the basic idea. It was human types. And if you look at the Free Survey, the Edgar Mitchell Free Survey, that's the number one alien that's reported, the being that's reported. It's not Grays. Number one is a human type. Number two is a ball of light, like a spirit type thing. Grays is number three. So if you talk to the actual people who are involved, the Grays sort of go down the chain of they're not the big thing that they are. But the Grays don't appear until the 60s.
Which indicates maybe Grays are not what they've been cracked up to be. Hold it there.
Yeah.
We're at the top of the hour. Station break coming up. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, Grant Cameron, and we're going to pick up on a weird story when we return. And we are back on the other side of midnight on this last morning of the week, the first week in June. Is it already the first week in June? Where the heck is this year going? We're almost at the solstice. I was watching the sun almost setting behind Cabazon tonight, which is this gorgeous western mesa. It looks like something right out of Close Encounters, like that huge uplift in the movie. And just to the left of it, there was lightning stabbing the ground as a thunderstorm was receding into the west. Okay, weird stories, Grant.
Okay, so Wilbur Smith, when I talked to his wife, this is when she confirms to me that he's a contactee. And she was talking about this alien by the name of Alpha. And she was talking about this guy like he was the family dog. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I was floored. I'd come from, you know, chasing a bunch of lights around, which who knows what they are, to suddenly, this is for real. I mean, this woman is, you know, Secretary of Speaker of the Senate. She's, sort of an older lady. Her son is not, you know, laughing. And she's telling me all these stories about how this alien was giving Wilbur material, and then they mentioned this psychic, and this is where the weird thing and synchronistic thing happens, is that what Wilbur did was he was very open-minded. So he said, anybody who's in contact with these beings, contact me. And he was putting together what everybody was saying about and trying to cross-index what people were saying and seeing if there was any similarities.
He was a real scientist.
Yeah. And one of the people that he used, there was a number of people. The alien's name was Alpha. And he had a number of different ways to communicate with this Alpha. One was through a radio telex operator in Ottawa.
Right.
And this guy was a blind telex operator, and he would actually just phone, and he would say, I've got a message from Alpha. Alpha says this or Alpha says that. So that was one. There was an engineer in Ottawa who was in contact. And then there was this particularly strong case. There was a woman in Elliott, Maine. Her name was Frances Swan, and she was the main contact that Wilbur used for Alpha. Now, she's significant because a number of reasons. If you look at there's two documentaries I always say to people, you got to take a look at that are significant. These are not just ordinary documentaries. One is this UFO cover-up live that played in October of 1988. The other one is the UFOs Past, Present, and Future, which played in 1975.
Now, do we have those linked on your page tonight?
I don't believe so.
Because if we don't, at the next break, which will be up in 3 minutes, send the links to M. We'll have them posted so people can go to the links directly and see these two critical docs on ufology.
Okay. So in the 1975 documentary called UFOs, Past, Present, and Future, which was redone in 1979 with Brad Steiger narrated it and Jacques Vallée got involved, it's called UFOs It Has Begun. That's the one that's on the internet. UFOs It Has Begun, 1979. So during this documentary, Bob Emmenegger, who was the co-producer of it, he's sort of the guy who's doing the work, gets put in contact through Alan Sandler, who was sort of the intelligence guy, the other co-producer who has the connections, to Arthur Lundahl. Now, Arthur Lundahl is a key guy in the Kennedy administration. He's the guy that claimed that he briefed three presidents on UFOs. He's also very famous for being the guy who went into Kennedy's office to brief him on the Cuban Missile Crisis, because he was a photographic expert. During the Robertson panel, he ran the Navy lab that did the analysis for the Robertson panel on all the videos and the
I'll tell you what, this is going to go long, so hold it there. We're five after the hour. My guest this morning, Grant Cameron, we're talking ufology. Isn't that strange? But we're talking ufology with evidence, and the evidence is going to get much stranger. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And we are back with my guest of the morning, Grant Cameron. Saturday morning, end of another week, middle of the year. I can't believe it's June. Where in the world is the year going? Okay, if you go to theothersideofmidnight.com and click on Radio with Pictures, that will take you to Grant's page tonight, the guest page. Scroll down to link number 9. Number 9? UFOs, It Has Begun. There's a link there, 1979. One of the two docs that you've recommended, Grant, and the other one we're going to have posted shortly. And the title of that one is again?
UFO Cover-Up Live.
Okay, and that should appear in the same window shortly. So let's pick up where we were.
Okay, so this second woman, her name is Frances Swan, and she ties into this guy by the name of Arthur Lundahl, the guy who claimed to brief three presidents, and the guy who briefed Kennedy on the Cuban Missile Crisis, because he's a photographic expert. So when they got the U-2s flying over Cuba, they're photographing launchers and missiles and stuff, and he goes into the president, he says, Mr. President, it's the launcher, this is this, and he does the whole deal. Now, in this documentary called UFOs It Has Begun, if you go to the link, you will see a interview that's done about him, and what it is done by Robert Friend, who ran Blue Book. Now, what happens is Emmenegger is put in contact with Arthur Lundahl, and Arthur Lundahl tells this story that they have this woman in Elliott, Maine. Now, this is the main contact that Wilbur Smith is using to talk to AFA.
And AFA is the, quote,
AFA is
alien.
The alien. So Arthur Lundahl tells this story. Emmenegger tries to get him to go on camera, and he said, no, I can't go on camera. You don't understand, Bob. Bob says, what do you mean? He says, I'm on duty. He ran the weird desk at the CIA. He ran all the paranormal stuff, all the UFO stuff at the CIA. He said, I can't go on camera. So they get Bob Friend to go on camera. You can remember, this is a story that the government gives them. Nobody knew about this story at all. And this story deals with July 1959. They first become in contact with this Frances Swann in Elliott, Maine in 1954. And she's channeling this AFA character. Two Navy intelligence guys talk to her. They get to know her. 1959, the cover story they have is they're going to get airtime for flight time. They fly up to Elliott, Maine to talk to her again. And they want her to talk to AFA, channel AFA. And she sits down, and she used to do it with automatic writing. And then she could do it just directly by doing this channeling type thing.
Mm-hmm.
She's talking to them. And
basically step aside, and they would talk to the agents through her.
And so then she says, why don't I just teach you how to do it?
Ah.
So the one guy, Navy intelligence guy, and this story is told on this documentary, he actually sits down, she puts his hand on his shoulder, and suddenly he starts channeling this AFA.
Oh, wow.
And he's all excited, and he goes running back, and he's Navy intelligence, but he's also CIA. He goes running back to Washington, D.C., and he goes to Arthur Lundahl. And Arthur Lundahl is running the National Photographic Interpretation Center. In Washington, D.C. This is in the slums of Washington, D.C. And this is where they analyze all the U-2 and all the SR-71 photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes running into Arthur and he says, she taught me how to do it. She taught me how to channel this alien. And Arthur said, great, sit down. Let's see what we can do. And this story is told in this documentary. And this is being told, you got to remember, this is being told by Robert Friend, who ran Blue Book, who said this was the most dramatic thing he'd ever seen in all his days at Blue Book. So the guy sits down, and they start asking him these questions. Do you favor any particular nation? Do you favor any particular religion? And they're asking all these questions. And this guy is basically doing this automatic writing thing where he's answering these questions, whatever. And then they say...
So he's not channeling, he's writing it down.
I believe he's doing automatic writing. And they say to him, okay, we want... Arthur Lundahl's conducting the interview. He says, we want some proof. And then the guy goes from automatic writing to talking. And he said, what do you want? And he said, we'd like you to show yourself. And he said, when? And Arthur Lundahl says, right now. And then the guy says, go to the window. And this is in this documentary. So they go to the window, and Robert Friend on the documentary actually shows the window. And outside the window, you can see the Capitol. And this flying saucer, this is daylight, flying saucer goes flying by and flies over the Capitol.
Right out of that 1957 movie.
Yeah.
The flying saucers have landed.
And so they're blown away by this. And Arthur Lundahl writes this memo that... He sends, and he gets Robert Friend from Blue Book. He phones Wright Patterson, and he tells him, get down here immediately. We got something we got to show you. So he flies in on this emergency meeting to Wright Patterson 2 days later, and they sit the guy down again. And they start the channeling session again, and Robert Friend talks about this. He says, you can see there's something going on. I mean, this Adam's apple is moving up and down. He said, it was the most dramatic thing he'd ever seen, that this guy was definitely talking to somebody. And they ask him the question, we'd like you to show yourself. And then AFA says the time isn't right. So Friend goes back to Wright Patterson.
Meaning physically in physical form.
The way he did the first time, flying by the window. They wanted him to fly by the window again.
Right.
And he said the time isn't right. So he goes back to Blue Book and he writes this memo that Jacques Vallée provides me later on after I put the story on my website. Jacques Vallée says, you got the story, here's the document. He provides me a document, and the story that's told is that Friend goes back and he writes this 11-page handwritten document of the memo that Arthur Lundahl put out that tells the whole story. And it's on what happens is it's on Friend's desk, and J. Allen Hynek sees this memo, and J. Allen Hynek hand copies this memo, which is given to me by Jacques Vallée. So it basically tells the story. So this is this woman from Elliott, Maine. Now, the weird thing is, Smith is going down there and he's talking to this woman, taking her very, very seriously. Same as there's a FBI document on her. The U.S. Air Force is looking at her. Our Arthur Friend says to the U.S. Air Force, he goes to his general, commanding general, and he says, there's something going on with this woman. We should investigate this woman. And the general says, there's another agency dealing with it, get your hands off. And he backs off and it never hears anything more about it. So there's all these different agencies in the United States and Canada dealing with this Frances Swan. Now the weird thing is Frances Swan is dealing with the blonde. She's dealing with the human type aliens. And so she goes to
also major, called the Nordics.
The Nordics, yeah, or they called them the blondes. This is what Betty Hill told me.
Mm-hmm.
Because Betty Hill gets involved in this. Betty Hill has her abduction experience in 1961. She goes to NICAP. She goes to Kehoe. Now, if you remember back, Kehoe was very interested in UFOs. He was into the sighting stuff, but he was not interested in the alien thing. He really wasn't really too much into whether they're aliens or whatever. So she comes in and tells this story. We were on this road, and these sort of gray type people with little hats on came and grabbed us and took us on the ship. And it was like, get out of here. Kehoe would have nothing to do with her. He basically told her to get lost. And so she's out in the cold, but a guy on the board for NICAP, whose name was Admiral Knowles, hears the story, and he happens synchronistically to live next door to this Frances Swan, who's the one that was channeling at the CIA at the National Photographic Interpretation Center. And he says, oh, I've got a friend, he says to Betty Hill, I've got a friend who will help you. She's channeling aliens and she can tell you what's going on. So Betty Hill tells me this story. She goes, they take her over to Frances Swan's place. She sits down and she starts telling her story. And Betty Hill and Frances Swan says to her, Grays, you were dealing with these gray type people? Oh, they're the evil ones. Get out of my house. And she throws Betty Hill out of her house. And so she has this very religious interpretation. She's dealing with the good ones, the blondes, and Betty Hill's dealing with the evil ones. And so she won't have anything to do with Betty Hill. But Betty Hill, I've got this writing. Betty Hill actually tells me this in the story. So this is who Wilbur Smith is dealing with. And he actually, in the documents, in the Air Force FBI document, which actually describes Wilbur Smith being there, and they black out all the names, but I can tell by who's there that it was Wilbur Smith that was there because from another country and stuff. He actually arranges for this thing to fly over Washington or Ottawa because Wilbur Smith had set up a station in the Defense Department property in Ottawa, outside of Ottawa, at a place called Shirley's Bay. Now, this is where they monitored all the Russian communication, which when I talked to the metallurgist who worked for Smith, he said, Wilbur had a very high security clearance. Don't you know that? And I said, well, yeah, he was doing this stuff. And he said, no, don't you know what he did? And I said, no. He said he ran Radio Ottawa. And I said, what's that? And he said, it was the thing that he was the head of all the communications in Canada. He allocated all the FM radio stations and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And he was the guy they were monitoring Russian communications. They had all these towers.
No, wait a minute. He was a government minister or was he?
No,
a minister?
He was the senior radio engineer for the Department of Transport.
Okay. But, and the Department of Transport was kind of like the FCC.
Yeah, and they at that time now it's the Department of Communications, but at that time it was all part of the Department of Transport. So they were monitoring Russian communications, and so Wilbur had access to all sorts of classified channels and intelligence stuff and like that. And he was very high level. This is what this metallurgist guy said. You got to realize who this guy was. He was a very high level guy in the government, even though that was never made public. And so he sets up in this place where they're picking off Russian communications. Sort of like the NSA of Canada, he sets up this flying saucer observatory where he's measuring five different things.
Like he was the perfect guy. He had the equipment. He had the expertise. He had the engineers. He had the government backing.
Yeah.
He could do a scientific study of UFOs with the equipment on site.
And in his writings, you'll see that he actually the aliens actually teach him how to build a device which he was communicating to them. And this Ernest Epp, who
wait first, a minute, they did you ever see a movie Metaluna? I forget the name of the title, but it had what was called an interocitor, which was a technology delivered by you know, FedEx to this scientist who builds this gadget that turns out to be able to talk to aliens. Yes. Is that what they gave him?
They gave him the instructions. Wilbur Smith always said, they give me hints. They don't tell me you have to work it out yourself, but they will give you hints. They will. So they gave him this device that he built for communicating with them. He also gave them an anti-gravity device, which his wife told me about. And well, there's about three things he built.
What happened to the anti-gravity device?
It was a device that he describes that they were working on, and the metallurgist told me about it. And there was a third guy who was where he had a group of people that were working with him off the record. There were government people working with him. They were working on it in the garage. And one of the weird stories to tell me about this guy,
Grant, do you understand what you just said? You got a bunch of guys standing around cracking alien technology in a garage.
In a garage.
Think about that.
Because they couldn't do it on government.
That's the Apple story.
Yeah. So they're doing this, and they get a phone call Saturday morning. The metallurgist tells me this story, and I heard it from one other guy before. So this story absolutely did happen. And Wilbur actually talks about it in one of his papers, but he doesn't get into the details. They're sitting there, and they get a phone call from the blind telex operator. And what it is they've got this plate, and it's a plate, and they epoxy these magnets. The metallurgist actually gave me one of these magnets that they had epoxied. And what they were doing is creating a spinning magnetic field. And they would have this plate with these magnets, and they would spin it about 18,000 revolutions a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And they had all these motors, and they would spin this thing. So there's their Saturday morning, and they get a phone call from the blind telex operator, and the telex operator says, "I got a message from Alpha. He said, shield the experiment." So Wilbur says, "Okay, shut it down. and they build them. The metallurgist tells me they build this brick wall around this thing. They start it up, and as they start it up, the thing explodes. And Wilbur, in the paper he wrote about it, he said, somebody might have got killed. There was ceramic magnets stuck in the wall. This thing just came apart. And so they build this thing, and Wilbur talks about it. They have this gravitational effect. It's like less 2% or 3% or whatever. And this thing, NASA has run it, and there's people in Norway or somewhere in Europe have actually run the same experiment, which is, you know, kind of weird that they'll all be running the same experiment by spinning a magnetic field at a very high revolution.
Well, but the variation is a scientist, I'm trying to remember where he is, Latvia, somewhere, maybe Moscow, Podkletnov.
Yeah, that could be the same one, yeah.
And he's been spinning a superconducting disk.
Yeah.
And measuring changes in gravity.
Yeah.
And inertia and stuff like that. So it sounds to me like the Wilbur Smith folks were doing it a generation or two earlier with non-superconducting magnets.
Yeah. And Wilbur's son told me they printed the book, I think it was 1964, they printed this book. He said the vast majority of books, like almost all of them, were sold in Scandinavian countries and Russia. They all went there. Almost nobody bought it here. And that's where this synchronistic thing where you suddenly get somebody there working on the same experiment. So Wilbur builds this thing, and then he goes to a guy by the name of Dr. Rose at the National Research Council. And he says to Rose, he said, "We've got this gravitational effect, and this is shown to me by the aliens, whatever." And Rose says, "Well, write it down, and we'll take a look at it." And he said, "Well, no, I'm going to write it down." And this is what his wife told me. She said he wouldn't write it down because Wilbur had 36 patents. A lot was for communication devices that they used on Department of Transport planes and stuff like that, and building stuff. And she said out of the 36 patents, the government seized 35 of them. There was only one patent that they actually got through. And she said they bought a car with the money they got from this patent, and the government was furious about it. So she said that the government, whenever Wilbur would develop something, she said the government would actually come into the house, walk down, grab the equipment, and go back out. And they said they controlled his time, and anything he developed was government property. So when he went to Dr. Rose, Rose says, "Write this thing down." He said, "No, I'm not going to write it down. If I write it down, you're just going to seize the equipment." Mm-hmm. And he said, "No, we're not going to look at it unless you write it down." And what his wife told me is Wilbur came home after that meeting, and he said, "That's it." He said, "I'm taking it apart." She said he took the experiment apart, and this is like 1959. He died in 61. And she said he never mentioned it again as long as he lived. And he said to her, he said, "It's probably better that I take it apart. It's better that the government doesn't get it, because if they do, all they're going to do is build bombs with it." And so he has this anti-gravity device. So there was a couple of things that he built. And he was getting this stuff from Francis Swan. And so in this, you'll see this, there's an FBI document, and the Air Force runs the same document, where he says, I'd like AFA to fly over the observatory in Canada. And she says, okay, they're going to do it August the 1st, on a Saturday, August the 1st, 1954. So it doesn't happen then. It happens the Saturday after. Wilbur Smith is at this station where they've got these five instruments or whatever. And Ernie Epp, the guy who originally tells me the story, is there. And he's the guy, as a very, very young engineer, he's the guy that's changing the you know, in those times they had paper running through the different instrument things with the pen and
yeah,
stuff like that.
They were called chart recorders.
Chart recorder. So he changed the paper and stuff in the chart recorder. And he said he was in the building when this thing went off. And he said they went running out. And Wilbur talks about this as well. They went running out. The thing went right off the chart. And so something had come over, and they went running outside. It was overcast, and they couldn't see. There was something above them, but they couldn't see. So Wilbur goes to the – and he was very famous at the time. You got to remember, even in the United States, Fate magazine, he was like the number one researcher in North America at the time, Wilbur Smith, because he was this high-level government guy who was openly talking about what he was doing. He goes to the media and
– and allowed, politically, Grant. He was allowed. Yeah. To me, that indicates he was a test. They were using him as a test to see politically and publicly and consciously – what would happen? What would the public do? What would governments do?
Yeah, until this day when this happened. Because he goes to the media and he says, if there's nothing wrong with the equipment, we've just detected the first flying saucer. He never used the word UFO. And he must have known this was like a cover story for, you know, to divert people away from what's actually going on. So he always used the word flying disc or flying saucer. He never used the word UFO. And he said, we've just detected, if there's nothing wrong with the equipment, we've just detected the first flying saucer over Ottawa. Well, that was end of the story. I mean, it's like a flying saucer over the Canadian capital, and boom, they shut the program down 2 days later. And they basically said, no, we didn't discover anything, and Wilbur Smith was allowed to use the equipment as long as he no longer spoke on behalf of the Canadian government. So from then on, he did this stuff in the garage. He would work secretly with these people in the garage. But before then, he had a bunch of full-time engineers working for him, and this is discussed in these famous government documents that we recovered in the Canadian archives and in his personal files, where he goes to the United States in 1950. Before he starts the project runs from 1950 to 1954. And before this project begins, he's going through the military liaison. You remember, he's a high-level guy. He's negotiating FM frequencies with the Americans. So he's in Ottawa. He's in Washington all the time. And he tells the story. I go to Washington, and I'm at some cocktail parties, and I bring up the subject of UFOs. I want to see what's going on. And there's a bunch of people who start talking about this. And I figured, where there's fire, where there's smoke, there's got to be fire. And so I decided to figure out what was going on. So he goes through the military liaison, whose name was Wright, at the Canadian Embassy. And this is the guy who could walk into the Research and Development Board in the United States, where Vannevar Bush worked. Now, Vannevar Bush was rumored to be the guy that ran the UFO program. He was the head of the Joint Research and Development Board in the United States. So Wright goes to the board, and he starts asking all these questions about flying saucers. And this is where the famous Canadian memo, which doesn't really get the recognition it deserves. Wilbur Smith gathers all the material that is collected by Wright, and he writes the famous top secret memo to the Deputy Minister of the Department of Transport. And in that memo, this is the one, top secret, it was Stanton Friedman helped get this document out in 1978. This is the one where Wilbur says, we made discreet inquiries in the United States as to the situation with flying saucers, and we were told by American officials, he doesn't say people on the street, he says by American officials, that one, flying saucers exist. Number two, it's the most highly classified subject in the United States, rated 2 points higher than the H-bomb. Number three, there's a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush who's trying to figure out the modus operandi of these objects. Number four, it's of tremendous significance to the Americans. And then the one that most interests me in the last couple of years is the very next line that pops into my head during a download experience I have in 2012. The very next line says, and we were also told by American officials that other things might be associated with the flying saucers. stressors, such as mental phenomena. And the Americans aren't doing very well because they say if we're working on the program, on the project, they'd like to exchange credentials and talk to us about it. Mm. So
hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. We'll pick this up exactly where we are when we come back. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And we are back with my guest this morning, Grant Cameron. You know, Grant, you should have written a book. Wait a minute. You have written a book, and I want to get to the book in the last half hour here, and I want to get back to the Clintons, the first president. I mean, against the backdrop of all this skullduggery and all these multiple stories and all these false leads and all the people that get so angry that they smash their equipment rather than let others have it, the government, whatever, there's now a major presidential candidate, and she's poised to become president, and we've got to context in this next half hour what that might mean. So pick up the story where you were, and then we'll go forward to Hillary.
Okay, so they shut down the Canadian government UFO program. And
What year was this?
This is August of 1954.
Oh, my God, that early.
And when his files become we started recovering some of his files. It's at that point we realized that there's this military liaison. We got the embassy documents. And that's when I start chasing that lead. To find out who did Wilbur Smith talk to in the United States. And we learned that he talked to this Dr. Robert Sarbacher. And then people started, Stanton Friedman, this is 1983, people started interviewing Sarbacher. And Sarbacher identifies Dr. Eric Walker, former president of Penn State University. So we chased him for 8 years.
Mm.
And I wrote the book, UFOs, MJ-12, and the government. About what Walker told us, and it's then I go to the president because Walker was going to give his files to the files that we wanted, the ones from the Research and Development Board, where he was for 1 year. He was the second guy in charge there. And I go to the Truman Library to get his files. I don't find his files there. I guess he didn't give them. And it's at that point when I have this question from 1975. I said, all I'm interested in is what somebody must know what I saw. And then I'm at the Truman Library looking for Walker's files. And it's at that point I asked the archivist, what do you got on UFOs? And that's my line on my site. What does the most powerful man know about the most important subject? Mm. And I asked the Truman Library, what have you got on UFOs? And they say, well, we got, you know, a couple of documents. We got some telegrams that were sent to the president in 1952 when the overflight took place. The first night, the Saturday night, it flew over.
Oh, and then the famous DC sightings.
DC sighting. And then
July 20th?
And then Truman puts out the shoot down order. And it goes all over the place, and the newspapers pick it up, and all these telegrams fly into the White House. Don't shoot them down. Don't shoot them down. And this is what they have in the archives. They have some of these telegrams that were sent to the president. Don't shoot them down. And then, of course, the second Saturday night, the thing reappears again. So I figure, well, that's kind of strange. There's not really much here. So I go down the road to the Eisenhower Library, which is about 120 miles down the road. One's in Independence, Missouri. The other one's in Abilene, Kansas, just down the road. So I go to the Eisenhower Library, and they've got 28 million pages of files. And I say, well, what have you got on UFOs at the Eisenhower Library? And they've got five documents. And one is the famous top secret document from the Robertson panel. And I go, something's wrong here. I mean, come on, five pages, got to be five documents. There's got to be something going on here. And it's at that point I decide I'm going to find out what does the president know about UFOs? Because I figure this guy, if anybody knows what's going on, this guy has to know what's going on. And I start this 30-year.
Well, Truman, the buck stops here.
Yeah.
And there's nothing on the most exciting subject during his administration.
Yeah. And I spend like 25 years chasing this around, and then I give up.
So before we start, hang on. Yeah. What year did you begin your presidential quest?
I'm not 100% sure. I would say it'd be the mid-1980s because I remember working with Billy Cox. Then he was with Florida Today. We were doing,
Billy. I know Billy, yeah.
Yeah, we did an article. He did an article based on my material on the Reagan alien invasion remarks. So I was in it when Reagan was still in. And I very closely watched the Clinton thing and then got my 15 seconds of fame when I recovered the 1,000 pages of Rockefeller Initiative documents. And I actually, you've got Joe Bookman on your show a couple of times,
mm-hmm.
and I actually gave up. I gave all the documents to Joe Bookman because he's, you know, the historical guy and, run, with the Independence Party and stuff. And I said, Joe, I've given up. The president knows what's going on. He's never going to tell you. This is a waste of time.
When did you give up?
The documents, that would be about within the last year.
Okay.
So I sent all the Rockefeller Initiative documents to him. I sent all my FOIAs that I got from the Clinton Library and stuff. I said, this was all a waste of time. And then Hillary makes a statement. And then back down the rabbit hole.
All right. So here we are. You have written a book. Let's use the book as a kind of an outline What is the is Hillary merely the most convenient, most palatable mechanism for Podesta, who's also not driving the train? So who's guiding Podesta? Is this disclosure on a timetable?
No, my impression of what's going on is that Podesta's behind the whole thing. And Podesta built, I call it the Podesta box. Podesta he was with the Clinton. He was there from day one till he said, I walked out the door with him.
Mm-hmm.
Podesta is an open government. He's a Madison man.
Well, wasn't he chief of staff for Bill for a time?
Yeah, and he was also an advisor in the early years of the Clinton administration on communications, and he was very much into government policy, something like that. But he was involved in these early executive orders, and this is a key thing to remember.
But wait, I want to give people a very clear idea of who this guy is, because he's not a household word. Podesta.
He is the most powerful Democrat in the country. I say he's the most powerful guy in the country.
Interesting.
He started the Center for American Progress in Washington, the big Democratic think tank.
Mm-hmm.
The Obama administration has 40 people from his high level people in the Obama administration come from his think tank.
Well, see, here's the connecting glue we got to lay out. He not only was chief of staff for a while under Clinton, right?
Right.
Okay. He also was chief of the transition team for Obama when Obama 8 years ago became president.
That's right.
Then he retired, went back to his center, came back to the Obama administration, served in the actual administration as a counselor, advisor, whatever. And then when he retired, he to go and join the Clinton campaign and become her national campaign manager, he left a tweet. A most provocative tweet, about the tweet.
This is written on the last day that he's in the Obama administration, which is significant, because you're not going to deep six the president as you're walking out the door.
No way.
So when I saw this, I talked to
Steve Bassett. Particularly if you need him for your candidate.
Yeah. So I knew something was up when I saw that tweet.
I mean, something big is up.
2015, something was up, especially when I talked to Steve Bassett, and he said, he copied Marie Dowd. And I said, really? And I looked at the tweet, and it's on there. And this is the thing with Podesta, is when Podesta says something, you listen four or five times, then give it a 3 or 4 days, then go read it four or five times more, and then you maybe understand what he's doing.
Now, people who may have missed that, John Podesta, when he wrote this amazing tweet the day he's leaving his second hit with the Obama administration, he's been an advisor, he's leaving that administration. He's going to go work with Hillary and get her elected. He sends a tweet on UFOs around the world, and he copies Maureen Dowd, who is a key op-ed writer for the New York Times. So he obviously wants this paid attention to.
Yeah, and I could never figure – it took me a year to figure out why he had copied her. When I found out why he had copied her, it all makes sense. It's like that's what I said. When you see John Podesta, you got to watch very carefully what he's doing, because he calls himself he belongs to the cult of non-personality. He's the guy behind the curtain. He doesn't come out publicly.
Nope.
He operates from behind the curtain. So when he copies Marie Dowd, I find out later why he copied Marie Dowd. And the reason he copied her was, you always think of the New York Times as this very anti, very straight anti-UFO newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
In 1997, during the Clinton administration, he did two investigations of Roswell. The first one doesn't mention the bodies. Bill Clinton goes to this famous speech he makes in Belfast, Northern Ireland. He says, you know, if the Air Force did recover bodies, they didn't tell me about it either, and I want to know. Mm-hmm. They do a second Roswell report in 1997, and that's where they come up with the crash test dummy thing about dropping these 6-foot-tall wooden dummies in 1953, which are misidentified as 4-foot-tall aliens in 1947.
Right, and the Air Force person spokesman says time compression. Time compression.
Yeah, and during press, when he's doing the news conference to release that, the reporters are laughing, and they think it's a big joke. And one of the people in the room is Marie Dowd. Oh. And she writes an article in the New York Times in 1997 and basically says, this proves this is for real. Nobody could come up with anything this stupid. This is the stupidest thing I ever heard. This proves that it's for real.
Maureen Dowd, the famed political reporter for the New York Times, writes after that Air Force briefing, the giggle briefing that, you know, Art Bell forevermore coined this term time compression to apply it to everything because it was so silly. So Dowd comes up on Podesta's radar as a correspondent at a high level at a major global newspaper who actually will take this subject seriously.
Yeah.
And interesting. So,
but that's the thing. He doesn't tell you what he's doing. You just read his stuff, and then you figure, like, why does he do this? And so this is where I got the idea that he's building a box. So he's with the Clinton administration.
No, wait. How do you define building a box?
Well, this is he starts during the Clinton administration, and for some reason, whatever, he's very much into the environment thing. So I think, well, maybe he's actually an experiencer. He says, I'm interested in sci-fi. He had the X-Files. He was known as the X-Files man in the Clinton administration. In his waiting room in his office, he has all this X-Files paraphernalia and stuff. So during the Clinton administration, he was known as the X-Files man. When he had his 50th birthday, when he was at the White House, Bill and Hillary host an X-Files birthday party for him. And this is the only FOIA that I got totally refused on. I asked for the photographs from that birthday party and a videotape that had been taken, 83 photographs and a videotape. And I was refused those, and I appealed it, and it was totally refused. I cannot have these things. They said privacy. And I said, well, he's a public official. You can't say Podesta's private.
Okay, so we don't have a lot of time here, and I want to get to the MacGuffin, which is, going to happen during Hillary.
He does these executive orders with Bill Clinton, 94, 95, 96. He releases a billion pages of declassified stuff. He's trying to get Bill to declassify.
Was he the guy responsible for Bill Clinton declassifying Project Corona satellite imagery?
I'm pretty sure.
Because
94, 15% of everything in the National Archives was declassified at once.
So let's cut to the chase, Grant. John Podesta is Mr. Disclosure.
Yeah,
and he's been working on a long-term plan. Now, obviously, he's fronting for other people behind him that we never are going to see. But Steve seems to think that his efforts, and I love Steve dearly, but when he said the other night it was his efforts that started getting all these reporters asking questions, and isn't it terrible that the networks won't ask the question? And then I ask him simply, well, if it's all coming from you and Paradigm, how come John Podesta keeps showing up, popping up, and talking to people like Jake Tapper about UFOs? It seems to me it's an in-house strategy, a timetable, a protocol, and you're part of their protocol.
Exactly.
Very upset.
Well, sure. It's like he's working with – if you look at Tom DeLonge, Tom DeLonge says that he contacted John Podesta, and John Podesta listened to his whole story and said, okay, I'll get back to you. And a couple of months later, Podesta phones him or contacts him and says, okay, I'll play the game. So he's one of DeLonge's contacts, and DeLonge is getting all this material. So John Podesta, he can't get Clinton to do it. Then he goes to – Barack Obama. He tries to get Barack Obama to do it.
You say he can't get Clinton to do it, or Grant, and this is going to probably be our biggest disagreement tonight.
Yeah.
Was it premature? Was it not time?
Well, Bill Clinton made the decision it wasn't time.
You're assuming that. You're assuming the president on this issue can make that decision.
I thoroughly believe everything that is classified, all classification, all security is done by executive orders, not by done by law. It's done by executive order, which means it's being run out of the executive office of the president. MJ-12.
But does that still mean it's the president making the decision, or is it someone telling him?
Well, if it's run out of the executive office, it has to be the president.
No, it has to be someone in the executive office. In other words, what I'm saying is, on this subject, Grant, this is a really crucial thing to have a conversation on.
Yep.
Does the duly elected government here in the United States that we elect Do they have any real role in this at all, or are they merely figureheads taking orders from whoever behind the scenes says it's now time to admit the human race is part of a larger reality?
Okay, that's a whole other interview. I used to say that. I no longer believe it.
And well, you don't have to do the whole thing. We can come back and talk about how you got there, but give us the kind of Reader's Digest version. What made you think the president now is the president? Because to me, the last real president we had was John Kennedy, and look what they did to him on this.
Oh, but that's the thing. People say, oh, Kennedy didn't know. I mean, he was out of the
loop. No, of course he knew. And they killed him for it.
But a lot of people say that Eisenhower gave the famous military-industrial complex speech that he lost control and he was warning people that the UFO stuff was out of control and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't. The speech was the military-industrial congressional complex. And everybody just keeps messing around with this thing. And then they say, oh, he was the last guy to know and Kennedy didn't know. But then Kennedy was going to give it to the Russians, so they whacked Kennedy. That's what they want you to believe. That's the cover story. The cover story is the president doesn't know. They want you to believe the Wizard of Oz is running the UFO cover-up. Because, Richard, you can't interview the Wizard of Oz. But I know the president. I can give you the president's phone number. I know what the president's phone number is. We know where he lives. And if it becomes known that the president of the United States is running the cover-up, that he's the Wizard of Oz, mm-hmm. it's over. The cover-up is over almost immediately. And that's my effort right now. Is in the last couple of days, you've seen the White House press has suddenly realized maybe there's something to this. And they asked the press secretary to the president, what's the deal with Roswell? I've gotten a hold of this reporter, and she says to him, what's the deal with Roswell? Is this national security? Are there ETs? Is this for real?
And wait. Back up. During the daily presidential briefing, you're saying that Josh Earnest, the president's press secretary, a few days ago got a request from a reporter in the press room asking about Roswell, via the Hillary rumor now?
It started right after the New York Times article on May the 10th. The next
finally,
day,
my God.
He took two questions that day, and they were serious questions. One was from, I think, ABC. I mean, these were serious questions. It was no longer joke. It was like, is this thing for real? And he would answer the question. He says, I don't have a tab in my briefing book for that. And he said, he actually outs the president. He says, well, President Obama has indicated jokingly that his position gives him access to this type of material. You should ask him. It should be interesting.
Grant, hang on a second. You just said something really important. Do you know anything about Masons? The Masonic tradition, Freemasons?
A little bit. I read your book on this.
Okay, do you know one of the key precepts about Masonry in terms of secrets and all that?
Okay, I don't know.
You have to ask the question. You don't get an answer till you ask the question. Josh Earnest, representing the President of the United States, told us through you, through that reporter, you have to ask the question.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so...
But wait a minute. Jimmy Kimmel's asked, and others have asked, and he's always made a joke.
Okay, he made a joke, but what did he say? If you look at the Obama question, there was a review done by Ben Hansen... And when the Obama question starts from Kimmel, he says, you realize they're going to be watching what your reactions and how you swallow and stuff, because Ben Hansen had done the analysis on Bill Clinton, who was on there. So Obama knew when he was going to answer the UFO questions. He knew the UFO questions were coming. He knew that Ben Hansen was going to do a review and watch how he swallowed, how he motioned with his hands to see whether he was lying or not. And so when he asked him the question, he asked the denial question, the old story. Oh, the president doesn't know. He says, Bill Clinton told me he was there. He went into the White House. He couldn't find anything. So what about you? And as he's asking this question, he says, what about you? When you got there, what did you do? And Ben Hansen, when he does the review, watch the review. Ben Hansen's watching
Ben Hansen. Who's Ben Hansen?
He runs Fact or Faked TV show. And he worked for the FBI, and he can do analysis on people's reactions.
Oh, so he's a body language interpreter guy.
Yeah, and he determined that Bill Clinton wasn't telling the truth. And so when Barack goes on there, that's when you see at the beginning of the interview, he says, you realize they're going to be watching what you're going to do. And Clinton knows, yes, this analysis is going to be done. And so when they ask the question, you remember Barack, when he first started, he didn't have the lapel pin, the window where the American flag.
Right.
It's on high definition TV. And as he's being asked this question, Bill said he didn't find anything. What did you find? Ben Hansen does the review, and he's breathing 42 breaths a minute. He's hyperventilating. As
who?
This
Barack Obama? When Kimmel asked him the question.
When that question is being asked, he's breathing 42 times a minute because they're watching the lapel pin move up and down.
Oh.
And he says, I can't reveal anything. And then he makes the joke. Oh, the aliens are controlled. They won't let us do it. And he makes the joke, but he answers the question.
Okay, but wait a minute, Grant. Isn't that affirming my model and your initial hypothesis is the president can't reveal anything because he's not the guy who can reveal it?
No, because it's a waived, unacknowledged special access program. And if you take a look at John Podesta, for example, John Podesta will talk in rhymes and riddles about this thing, but he's getting Hillary out of the email scandal where she's under prosecution, a class one felony for mishandling classified material. And it's classified, it's unacknowledged, which means even the existence of the program is unacknowledged. You can't acknowledge that there is a UFO program. You can't say, well, it's classified, I can't talk about it. It's unacknowledged. So you can't acknowledge it. So he says, I can't reveal it. He can't talk about it. It's unacknowledged.
Now, hang on. The president of the United States says, in code, you're saying to me,
yeah,
that these programs exist, but I can't acknowledge them.
I can't reveal it.
If the president can't reveal them, why can't he reveal them? He's the one that decides what is classified or not classified. Ultimately, Obama can go out tomorrow and declassify anything on the planet, and exactly. Nothing can touch him legally.
And that's exactly what Podesta said when he talks about Hillary. You watch what he says. Watch carefully what he says. He says Hillary has to sit down with the material, and she has to look at it, and she has to weigh national security versus what he calls unthinking secrecy. She has to weigh it and reveal whatever she can, which indicates she has access. She's going to have all the material. She's going to put it in front of her. She weighs national security, and she decides what can she reveal. And John Podesta is on the record as saying, quote, there are classified documents that can be declassified. So he's basically saying there's a cover-up. He knows there's stuff, but he can't talk about it either. And if you take a look at Barack Obama, you say, well, Barack Obama, when he was at Roswell, he says in Roswell, talking about Roswell, he said, we'll keep our secrets here. So Podesta tries to get Obama to disclose, and for whatever reason, Obama and the group of people that make the decision say, no, we're not going to do it, and that's why he puts the tweet out.
Grant, it's not time yet.
Well,
why
exactly.
Is it so obvious to me this is on the clock? And everything that's happening is on the clock, and there's going to be disclosure. Our physics model says this year, end of this year, the solstice, the end of 2016, beginning of 2017, 17 Egyptian ritual, reincarnation, rebirth, phoenix, all that. That's when this bombshell is going to hit somehow, some way. And this is all arranging the deck chairs on the non-Titanic, because we're not going to sink under this. This is going to be our reincarnation. This is going to be our launch to a – talk about making America great again. This would launch us into 10 American centuries if they seize the day.
Yeah, and that's what Podesta seems to be setting up. He says, like, quote, I think I convinced her, which means I couldn't convince Bill to do it. I couldn't convince Obama to do it, but I think I convinced Hillary to do it. And then when Hillary talks about it, she will never say, this was my idea. She just says, oh, I'm interested in the subject. But she says, this is John's idea. So he's the fall guy. She doesn't take the rap for it. She's not going to get blamed for it. It's John's idea. And she says, I'm interested in open government. And that's John Podesta. John Podesta is a Madison guy. He says, you cannot run a country. You cannot vote unless you know what the government's doing. Your vote is meaningless. He's a big open government guy. Mm. So she gives the line that I'm doing it for John. She'll say a number of times, she said, I promised John I'll do it. So John talks Hillary into doing it. And then you take a look at the question again. Does the president know?
Grant, this sounds so problematic, and perchance, and if they have the right coffee on the right morning and they make the right decision.
But she's in a box.
I don't think free will is operating. I think they're all under orders. On a certain time, it has to come out, and it's how it comes out.
Oh, for sure. I talked to somebody in the field who showed me the evidence that he's definitely in contact with the Obama administration and high level people. And I know three of the people that he's referred to, and he said they want it out, but they don't want the government's fingerprints on it. And I said, well, good luck for that. And that this is there's an operation. That's what John has done. John has built a box that I can't see how they can get out of. Because now Hillary is in the position where she said, I'm going to look at it. I'm going to disclose it. So say she comes out and she says, it's national security. It's game over.
Here's an important question. Bassett's position is Hillary is not going to reveal, because she can't, because she has no power. What she's doing is setting it up so Obama reveals, hands it off to Hillary, and then she prosecutes disclosure. That's his model.
I would tend to agree. I've changed my opinion. I thought he was setting up Hillary to do it, that Hillary was on position that she was going to go and take a look at it, and she would have to make a statement what she found and whether it was national security, which confirms there's a cover-up. But then when suddenly the story breaks and the White House starts getting questions, it's not going to last. There's no way it's going to last.
That's what Steve's been saying. If you build up the pressure enough, the press – because what this does, it also fulfills that first Masonic ritual precept, which is – you got to ask the question.
So I go to the White House reporters, and I'm trying to get a hold of all the ones that asked the question, and say to them, don't waste your time if you get a chance, because they're waiting for Obama to do a press conference, and then they may ask this question. And I said, do not waste your time with asking about UFOs. Ask him one simple question. Mr. President, were you briefed on the subject? This is a question I asked Dick Cheney. Were you briefed on the subject of UFOs? If so, when was it and what were you told? Let's put it on the record. Are you briefed on the subject? And I told her, if the president says, yes, he was briefed, it's over. Because you do not brief the president on something that doesn't exist. If it gets briefed, then the media, the White House, they say the New York Times, the Washington Post, suddenly realize there's a story here.
Okay.
The president knows about this.
Okay.
And it all unravels. And
we need more time. We need more time. Look, Grant, you got to come back. This is moving at Warp 9. There's going to be major developments, maybe as soon as next week. So stay by your phone. Hey, Grant Cameron, my guest tonight. This has been an extraordinarily interesting insight into what actually could happen in our lifetime in the next few months, if not a year or so. So stay tuned. Until then, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. See you all Tuesday. Have a great weekend, everybody. Good night.